The U.S. is a few months into what health experts are calling the first wave of the coronavirus pandemic. The death toll climbs higher every day, and hospitalizations are spiking in many parts of the country. We're likely also still a long way from a vaccine. But a strong preventative measure exists: masks. 22 states have mask mandates in place for public spaces, and many others have some other type of mask law. Still, some people are not on board with wearing a face covering. Nancy Cass is the Deputy Director for Public Health with Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and she joins me now. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anita. Nice to be with you.
And we'd also like to hear from you. If you have any questions about masks and face coverings, you can tweet at us or comment on our Facebook live stream. So, Nancy, you are a public health expert. Give us your short and sweet case for why we should be wearing masks.
Well, thanks. The coronavirus, it's obvious to say, has devastated America. It has made a lot of people severely ill, or sadly, a lot of people have died. And for everyone else, it has shut down the economy in most parts of the country. Any strategy we have in place that will both protect people and allow stores and restaurants to reopen is something that really should be put in place. Masks are one of those tools.
So one of the things that makes this a little bit complicated is that the health guidance on masks has shifted over the course of this pandemic. At the beginning, officials from the CDC downplayed the efficacy of masks. Now they're recommended. And there's been a lot of heat on our national officials about this. Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked directly about the effect of this messaging in an interview on NPR recently. I want to listen to quickly what he said.
You are right, and we have to admit it, that that mixed message in the beginning, even though it was well meant to allow masks to be available for health workers, that was detrimental in getting the message across right now. No doubt about it.
So that's Dr. Anthony Fauci in an interview with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. I'm talking with Nancy Cass of Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. So talk to me about the public health messaging around masks and how it shifted and what you think the significance of that shift is.
Yeah, it's a really important point. It would be great in public health if we knew all the answers at the beginning. But the problem is that we don't. And one of the communication basics in public health is to, as often as possible, start a communication by saying, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. And based on that, here's what we're advising. It's easy to do the 2020 looking back now, but in the ideal world, one could imagine it might have been helpful to say, look, we know that cloth masks are never going to be as good as hospital masks. We honestly don't yet know how good they are, but here's why we think that taking that precaution is helpful. As soon as we have more information, we'll let you know. And then as more studies, and I understand that, you know, later in the hour, Dr. Scott Siegel is one of your guests. He certainly has conducted one of these studies. As studies become available that start to indicate which types of masks actually do provide what kind of protection, and also as studies come out that in regions of the country where there is a lot more mask wearing, the incidence of new disease is going down, the more the public health experts can come back on and say, remember, we told you it was just a precaution, and now we can really tell you that it's making a difference. Wear this kind of mask, wear it whenever you go out in a public place, it will make a difference.
It's going to make a difference. It's not perfect, but it's better than nothing. We're going to continue our conversation on the ethics of masks, and we will also talk with Dr. Siegel about his research on masks and fabric and what works best. Stay with us on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. In early April, President Trump announced the CDC would recommend face masks to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Since then, a public debate over whether or not people should mask has clouded public health discussions. I'm here with Nancy Cass, the Deputy Director for Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. So a big part of what has kind of spilled out into the public debate is this question over kind of who has the right to tell whom what to do. And I would love to hear you weigh in on that from a public health history perspective. Is there a historical precedent for these kinds of mandates that are designed to protect public health? And how does this compare?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are public health departments in every state in the United States and in all cities. And public health departments actually have written into their formal mandate a requirement essentially to both create the conditions under which the public in their jurisdiction can go about their business and be protected from health threats, some of which might be invisible health threats, and also that they actually have the power. It is in most of these writings actually called the police power to have the authority to, for example, shut down restaurants or close businesses or take away an animal with rabies, to also isolate someone who, for example, has tuberculosis, who's not taking their medicine. It is the job of public health to essentially keep everybody in the community safe. There are many tools in the public health toolbox that have been used for more than 100 years that allow public health to do that job. And again, people are familiar with these, as I said, closing restaurants, the requirement of vaccination before our kids can start schools. All of these are things that public health has a mandate to do in order to protect the people who live in their community safe from health-related threats that can be essentially just out there in the community and often that members of the community might be unaware of.
So even with public health has this mandate, we have data that says, you know, overwhelmingly we know that it does help reduce spread if people are wearing masks. But there are still plenty of folks that are not wearing them and that are choosing to not wear them. How do you engage those individuals? What kind of tactics work best and what don't from a public health perspective?
Sure. So one thing that I will say in answering your question is that it obviously works better if the messaging is consistent. Again, another piece of basic public health communication is that the political leaders are supposed to leave the messaging to the public health experts, essentially turn to the Dr. Fauci's of the world and say, what's your recommendation? And a handful of public health voices say things like, everybody should be wearing masks when they go outside. The more that these conversations get infused with politics, the more challenging they become because there are now suddenly lots of voices, and it sounds like mask wearing is a matter of opinion rather than based on public health data. Having said that, with your question about what's the best communication, this is another area where research is essential. We know from other public health communication that the same messages don't resonate with all people. There might be some people for whom mask wearing is compelling if they saw a message that said something like, I'm doing my part to help my sister-in-law with leukemia or my sister-in-law with diabetes. There might be other people who are influenced by a message that says something like, I'm helping my city stay open. And the more we understand what are the messages that appeal to different audiences, as well as even things as basic as the marketing of different styles of masks with different messages and different logos and different prints on the material, the more we start to understand what is going to make someone say, yeah, I'm gonna wear the mask, I'm going to get a sports mask or something like that, that starts to appeal to different groups.
That's interesting because it kind of mirrors so much of general conversation. I mean, throwing data at people tends to not change minds, but having kind of creating a space for an empathic connection or something that someone can buy into from their own intrinsic motivations tends to create change. So it follows some of those similar guidelines. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I want to pick up on your point about empathy. I actually think it's really important for the people who are giving the messages about masks to acknowledge why people don't like to wear them. For some people, they just simply don't like to be told what to do. And that's a point you already raised. For other people, it's the middle of summer now. And a lot of the parts of the country where there is such a big surge in cases, Texas, Florida, Arizona, it's really hot outside. And acknowledging, I know it's not really pleasant to wear that mask for a long time. Try to do your business as quickly as you can. Here's why it's still important. And thank you for doing your part. I think is a helpful piece of the message. It's not just do this, but we acknowledge it's not perfect. We wish we had better tools. We're working on better tools. We're working on that vaccine. But until we have that, we all have to sort of do our part. And sometimes it's a little hard, but it's so that the businesses can reopen and fewer of these people can end up in the hospital.
So as it works in North Carolina, enforcement falls to businesses and stores. So I want to play a clip from Doug McKay. He's an associate professor of public policy and a member of the Center for Bioethics at UNC Chapel Hill, kind of addressing this enforcement challenge. Let's listen.
People who are going to be the de facto enforcers are going to be people working in retail stores, grocery store workers, people working at Lowe's and Home Depot. And these are going to be people who are going to be at risk of personal abuse or violence from people who are asked to wear masks and then refuse. And so we've all seen, you know, videos online of examples of this happening. These are also folks who don't have the training in conflict resolution or have training in self-defense. So things that might help them minimize the risk of confrontation or minimize their risk of violence or enable them to protect themselves.
So that's Doug McKay, a public policy professor at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm talking with Nancy Cass of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. So we're talking about things that kind of sound like the opposite of an empathic connection, but people are in a really vulnerable position. If you work in a business, you're exposing yourself, and there are people around you who aren't wearing masks, and your business is going to get fined if they're not doing it. Do you have any thoughts about how these workers should approach someone who isn't masked while in their place of employment? It's kind of tricky.
It's really tricky. And honestly, I feel for them because it shouldn't be left to them. They shouldn't be the ones who get punished for having a customer who is not doing their part. Having said that, something that I think can diffuse this to some degree is having signs or flyers posted on the doors on the entry to businesses that say, please put on your mask before coming in, or only allowed in the store with a mask, the same way lots of stores already say only allowed in the store if you have shoes on, and to make that very clear. And maybe even something at the bottom that says, ask us if you forgot yours. And the cashiers can all have a box of disposable masks sitting under their counter. I also think that it potentially could be helpful if the person in the shop says something like, oh, sorry to bother you, but we are required and we are going to get fined if our customers are not wearing masks. I'm not even going to go there on my own opinion about masks, but I don't want our store now that we just opened to get fined. So if you would help us out, if you want to be in the store. So something that essentially doesn't make it an argument between the customer and the merchant, but allows the merchant to essentially, and this is 100% truth-telling, deflect it to where the authority is really coming from and their own vulnerability, which is essentially, help me out. I'm not saying I am asking you to wear the mask. I'm saying I am going to get fined if you don't wear the mask. And the hope is that there will be a little bit of sympathy there. Honestly, if a customer refuses, I don't really know what the person can do. Doug is absolutely right. These people aren't trained in conflict resolution. Some of them are going to be, you know, 18-year-olds working in a store. As I started, I feel for these people. I do think there's a couple strategies that will help, but ultimately there's only so much they can do.
Nancy Cass is the Deputy Director for Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Thank you so much.
A pleasure to speak with you. Take care.
So say you're already compliant with North Carolina's mask mandate. You understand the science. You bought a cloth mask from a sewing savvy friend. Maybe you even have a couple on hand for when your first one gets dirty. Well, how do you know if you're wearing your mask correctly? Is it the right material? Should you wear it whenever you step outside of the house or just to the grocery store? Here to answer those questions is Dr. Scott Siegel. He's the chair of anesthesiology at Wake Forest Baptist Health and a professor of anesthesiology as well. Dr. Siegel, welcome to The State of Things.
Hello, Anita. Thank you for nice to be with you.
Of course. And if you have any questions for him, anything about masks, feel free to tweet at us or comment on our Facebook live stream. So you heard us talking a bit about these ethical questions. From your perspective as someone who studies this, do you think there's anything inherently American about the way we're talking about mask wearing right now as opposed to how things are going in other countries?
That's an interesting question. You know, I'm certainly not an expert in sociology, but I do believe that here in this country we have a very tight embrace of personal freedoms, and I can absolutely see people saying this is my choice. I think Dr. Cass was spot on by trying to turn that conversation around and say, hey, this is being, wearing a mask helps other people. So you want them to do that for you, don't you? You should do that for them. That's, I wear a little button when I'm walking around town that says, I'm wearing this mask for you. Please wear yours for me. And I hope that that message will stick. Certainly other countries have a long tradition of wearing masks or being more accepting of public health mandates like this. You know, I think personally back to the time when smoking regulations in restaurants were a brand new thing and there were people who bucked that, but now it would be unthinkable to smoke in a restaurant. That's just not where the culture is, and so I'm cautiously hopeful that we'll get there with masks too.
So tell me about cloth masks and what you have uncovered about what they do to slow the spread of COVID-19.
So we started studying cloth masks for a lot of the reasons that were happening when the pandemic was brand new. We were really worried about running out of personal protective equipment in the hospital, and we had lots of volunteers. There's an avid sewing community here in Winston-Salem who were making masks. And we took a look at these boxes of masks that people had donated, and we asked the question, are any of these any good? How do they compare to medical-grade masks? Should we run out? Could we use these as an alternative? And that prompted us initially to start this investigation. We subsequently obviously have moved in a different direction. Thank goodness we do seem to have enough medical-grade PPE right now, but we're working now to try to advise the public. So very briefly, we studied how well masks of different designs and different materials would filter out microscopic particles. These are tiny, tiny particles, a tiny fraction of a millimeter, just a micron or two or less in diameter. And we simply measured the percentage of those particles that could be trapped by a mask. And what we found was surgical masks trapped about 60 or 65% of the smallest particles, and N95 respirators, the 95 means 95%, did in fact filter that much. But cloth masks were all over the place.
Hmm.
We had some that filtered better than surgical masks. 72, 79%, I think, was our best. And we had some that were well under 20% and were much, much less effective.
So which cloth masks work best? I guess maybe we can start with fabric and then we can go to fit and how both of those two are important.
Sure. Most of our volunteers used cotton materials. And what we found was higher grade cotton cloth, what sewing people will tell you is called quilter's cotton, performed better than simple printed cotton fabrics that you might find in a big box discount fabric store. These fabrics tend to have thicker yarns with tighter weaves, often a higher thread count. Under an electron microscope, you can see that the spaces between the fibers are much, much smaller than they are in the lower grade cottons. And we found that two layers of that material was the most effective. There were also some other designs, including an outer layer of a less higher grade, a lower grade cotton with an inner flannel layer that was also very effective.
If I don't have an electron microscope, how can I tell, and I don't know much about quilting, how can I tell if mine has the right fabric? Is there an
right,
easy test?
Right, that bothered me a lot, too, because I'm no clothing expert or fabric expert, not before this whole thing started. So the sewing people told me about a trick that they used to try to tell the difference between high-quality cloth and lower-quality cloth, and it really couldn't be more simple. You simply hold it up to a bright light, or even to the sun, if you're careful, and you observe whether the light passes through the cloth and sort of outlines the individual fibers. If it does, that means the light is shining between the spaces in the weave of the fabric, and that's probably a less effective filter than one that seems to not show the light passing through that much. Now, all cloths are somewhat opaque, and if it's a dark color, a lot of light won't get through, but what you're looking for is whether it outlines the individual fibers or not. And we believe that to be the simplest test of higher quality versus lower quality fabric.
And are we keeping both things from coming in and going out, or is it more about keeping things from escaping from our own mouth, our own droplets, our own aerosolized particles?
Well, that's a really, really important question, and I'm afraid the answer isn't simple. As Dr. Cass was discussing with you, the public health rationale for us all wearing masks is to block your respiratory droplets from getting to somebody else in case you're infected and don't know it, if you're asymptomatic or what we call pre-symptomatic. That's the public health rationale. And in that regard, trapping those larger respiratory droplets that come out of our mouth and nose every time we breathe or speak, and particularly if we shout or sing or cough or sneeze, that's the principal rationale. Now, our view is that if you're going to go to the trouble of wearing a mask, it would also be helpful to try to block particles that are in the air, either by somebody who's not masked or even now where some concern about particles that last in the air a bit longer than ordinary respiratory droplets, which is why an effective filter coming in would also be helpful. And so we did study that material, those really, really fine particles, a fraction of a micron. And so I think ideally, if you have a choice, you'd like a mask that does both.
But it's a little bit to be determined how much these various materials can do both at this point.
Well, we tested for all of those. So
okay.
We tested particle sizes from 0.3 microns up to 10 microns. So we'd be getting close to those larger respiratory droplets in the larger size, and we'd be down close to the size of a virus or a bacterium in that smallest size. And so we tested them all. And the best masks would trap a high percentage even of those finest particles.
And does it matter? We've seen so many different styles. We've seen the behind the ear loop. We've seen the tie on. Does that matter very much?
Well, a good fit does matter. You want the mask to be closely worn, totally covering your nose and your mouth. And you don't want large gaps at the sides or at the top or the bottom, or you'll simply be exhaling and inhaling through those gaps. So, yes, it should fit well to your face. In our sort of informal evaluation, it looked like the tie-on masks were a little easier to get a custom fit and therefore to fit lots of different wearers' faces that might differ in size or shape. Although I'll admit the ear loop masks are very convenient. They're much faster to put them on and off. And if you're not used to tying a mask onto your face or onto your head, it's not that easy. You can learn. It's not impossible. We do it all the time, and I'm sure the public can learn. But the ear loop design is certainly more convenient. The problem is it's not really customized. There's little elastic straps, and either it fits well or it doesn't. There's some little devices you can get that you put behind your head, and you put the ear loops on little hooks on those straps. They're sometimes called ear savers, and it takes the pressure off your ears and also allows you to customize the fit a bit more as well.
All right, we're going to continue talking about this after we take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Scott Siegel, the chair of anesthesiology with the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. We're also going to talk a little bit more about fashion and mask fashion and how you can contain your spittle while also not cramping your style. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking about masks today. What kind of material and design is most effective at preventing the spread of viruses? How should you wear them? And what kind of mask is best? To answer your questions and mine, we are here with Dr. Scott Siegel. He's the chair of anesthesiology at Wake Forest Baptist Health and a professor of anesthesiology. So we got a question from a caller that I want to pose to you. So this is a question about if a doctor gets off duty and is on the way home running errands, how much of a risk is that to the public? And to kind of maybe make that a little bit more general, maybe you can talk about the importance of how you remove your masks or other materials that may be exposed and how important that is to the process.
That's a great question, and it's really important information to think about. So when you take a mask off, and this is true even for medical-grade masks, you don't want to handle the front of the mask, the part that you've been breathing in and out of. You want to handle the straps or the ear loops, and then you should wash your hands when you're done. What we do if we're going to be reusing a mask is we put it in a paper bag, paper rather than plastic, so it will dry out because we know that moisture makes them less effective and drying tends to improve that. So I would recommend that you remove the mask carefully by the straps. And then, of course, you should wash it periodically if it's a cloth mask. And we believe that just ordinary machine washing is the way to go on that. Now, in terms of being a risk to others, we used to worry a lot about things like could it be on your shoes or your clothing. And we think now that that is probably a relatively minor, probably negligible risk. The real risk is still respiratory spread.
So When we're talking about, I mean, in terms of North Carolina guidelines, they say if you're exercising outdoors and you can be socially distanced, it's okay to not be wearing a mask. But we've seen these studies about aerosolized particles and particles that can hover in the air for long periods of time. So should we err on the side of wearing a mask more often than not, or being outside exercising, are we okay to not be wearing one?
It's a tough question. I would say the answer, the short answer is err on the side of wearing a mask whenever you are in doubt. So I've certainly been out and about outdoors, not necessarily exercising, where there's lots of other people around, and I think you should wear a mask in that setting. If you're going to be jogging around your neighborhood or riding a bicycle and maybe only transiently pass another individual, I think there may be less of a mandate to wear a mask in a situation like that. Outdoors helps a lot because there's a lot of air and there's air currents that tend to blow away those droplets, even the microscopic particles. And there's been very, very few cases other than large groups of people standing very close together for a long time where there's been a lot of spread in outdoors. So I think, you know, you have to use your judgment. When I go walking in my neighborhood on a trail, if I know I'm just going to transiently pass another individual, I'm not wearing a mask, but I have one in my pocket just in case there's a group of people and I'm held up for a little while in a crowd.
So there has been some conversation I've seen mostly on the internet about people kind of promoting studies about masks limiting oxygen intake or leading to carbon dioxide poisoning, causing problems for people who have other respiratory issues. Is there any data to back those claims?
Probably not. I think this has reached the level of an internet meme now, and some of the folks who are against wearing masks, maybe for other purposes, are fond of citing that sort of idea. Masks really can't lower your oxygen level or increase your carbon dioxide level. I would say in perhaps in the most ill patients with pulmonary disease, there could be a small risk of worsening your ability to breathe. But no, a mask is not going to cause you respiratory problems. Now, I will admit, and I think you said this earlier in the show, wearing a mask is uncomfortable. Even for us healthcare professionals, masks are not comfortable, and they're really not comfortable outdoors on a hot day. And they can give people a feeling of difficulty breathing that is probably more of a subjective feeling, a reaction to a little bit of resistance to the air moving back and forth. And in some cases, you get a little anxious, and that makes you feel even less comfortable. But no, there's no real health risk of wearing a mask.
All right. One last question for you. If most of us, the majority of us, wore masks outside, say like 80 or 90%, or not outside, just we're wearing them most of the time when we're directed to do so, what would that do to the pandemic? How big of an issue is this mask wearing?
Well, I would say that the majority of the literature suggests that would have a dramatic effect, that when you compare countries that have only done social distancing to those that have also put in widespread mask wearing, there's a large difference in the case prevalence and in the shapes of the curves. The disease will decline if we can all get ourselves to wear masks. I am fond of a sort of a little quip that I heard that I didn't make it up, but I really believe it. If I told you that I had an intervention, a drug that would reduce the spread of this disease by up to 85%, cost about $2 and had no side effects, you'd call that a miracle drug. That's what masks are, and I think we all need to get over our objections and embrace this as a way to keep the economy open and yet still get ahead of the virus.
All right. Trust the doctor there. Dr. Scott Siegel, the chair of anesthesiology with Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
So let's turn now from function to fashion. Covering the nose and mouth is a basic principle, but it doesn't mean you have to look basic while doing it. Since the first weeks of the pandemic, home designers have completed their look with flashy masks. Now, the fashion industry has caught up, and what was once a marker of artisanal public health is now mass-produced. Yet some fashion designers are continuing to offer innovative designs made at home. Shakuru Couture is a family business that is selling out of its fantastical mask designs. Their shimmering sequin patterns and intricate geometry are extremely Instagrammable, but most importantly, they keep the droplets in. Shakuru Bilal is the founder, owner, and lead designer for Shakuru Couture. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your masks are absolutely incredible and so wonderful to look at. I've just been really enjoying looking at them on your website. And I'd love for you to maybe describe some of the materials and your design process. And maybe let's just pick one that's my favorite, the Blowing Bubbles scarf. So you have this scarf and this mask that has all of these iridescent particles and does the whole full face covering. So tell me about this one.
Okay, that one in particular, that came out for the initial launch of masks, and I was thinking, what else could we do that could be fun and light and just something just different? And I didn't know how it would go over, if people would really like it or not, but they actually love it, and it's low in stock right now, but we restock daily on all of the masks as much as we can keep up, but it's like a fantasy almost. It's escapism.
So what made you decide to create these masks that really do much more than just function? They're really beautiful and they really make a statement.
Well, it's an offshoot of our design company. My daughters and I, we have a design company, and we were just about to launch our spring line, and then the pandemic hit. So this was our pivot, the mask. And so it was natural that the mask would be as a glamorous or high fashion and sparkly as our fashions are. So I started with maybe some basic African print masks. I don't want to say basic, but some simple African print masks. And then I just thought, well, why not just really have fun with it? Just have fun, offer people some escapism, some stress relief so that people can just feel free to express themselves on social media outlets. When they get a chance to go out, which people are having more of a chance to go out now than they were before.
And how much does the science inform the kinds of masks that you're creating, the science about fabric and fit and that kind of thing?
Okay, initially, that was my research. I researched just everything that I could find from the WHO and just anything on the internet, just speaking about, just talking about fabrics, cotton fabrics, synthetic fabrics, if some of those do work, and if the weave is too tight, then you actually can't breathe. If it's stretchy, it stretches too much, and it allows too much in. And we even inform our customers that some of the masks that they provide adequate protection, but it still may not be enough. So they can wear it over an N95 or another mask cover. And we have a built-in pocket on our mask also that the client can insert their own filter into for additional protection.
So as you have shifted your business to creating a lot of masks, how has that changed your aesthetic, or has it? I mean, how is this creating this particular item posed an interesting challenge for you as a designer?
Well, I think since it was an offshoot of what we were already doing, the challenge that it proposed to me was that I felt like I couldn't be as creative as I wanted to be with the mask, because I still needed to keep it within a certain shape and a certain fit and just a particular cut. So I tried with different designs, and my daughters were like, no, you have to go back to the drawing board on that one. So we went through the process of filtering out which ones would be more effective, which ones would clients be more receptive to, and just what was authentic for the Shakura Couture brand. And we came up with that just doing glam.
So you consider yourself part of the modest fashion industry, the modest fashion movement. Can you tell me a bit about that and a bit about the particular clientele that you are working to serve?
Okay, with the modest fashion industry, currently it is a multi-billion dollar business. And actually, I've been doing modest fashion for over 30 years. And myself and my husband, we used to travel the country getting paid to do our own shows. And it was modest fashion shows. They were glamorous, and they're swinging fabric. I called it my swing coat. That was my signature was a swing coat, and lots of moving fabric. Sometimes it was heavy, which wasn't always conducive for particular clients and particular climates that we were traveling to. But it was beautiful, and people were very receptive to it. And but with the modern fashion industry, now it's more focused. It's more geared towards saying it's for Muslim women. However, my history with modern fashion It was for just women who wanted modest fashion, period. They may be Hebrew Israelite. They were Rasta. They were, They would be Muslim women, yeah, naturally. But Christian women from the churches, I would do a lot of their events, and I was huge with them. And they loved it because they wanted modest fashion.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, covering various parts of your body, covering parts of your face is not new for people in various religious and ethnic traditions. It's new for a number of people who have not had that background. But as you transition to maybe making for a broader clientele, is there anything that you are thinking about in terms of how to communicate about your business and what you're trying to do?
Well, we recently received some mentoring advice from Tanya Sam. He's from Atlanta, Real Housewives of Atlanta. And so she told us is that, and looking at our brand initially, is that she couldn't tell is that we were a modest fashion. That's because we were trying to hit on different markets and to be versatile in that. We didn't want to exclude anybody. But we took her advice, and we solidified our brand as modest fashion, period. So that's where we stand right now with that.
One of the things I've been thinking a lot about with more people wearing masks is that your eyes are kind of your primary mode of being able to communicate. You have to communicate so much with your eyes when the rest of your face is covered. Does that, knowing that, shape how you design the masks, the kind of fabric you use, the kind of colors? Are you trying to accentuate the eyes at all?
You know what? When I wear a mask personally myself, I think about if you wear these masks so much and they kind of pull downwards on our face and can leave a little mark on your face. And so I smile underneath my mask. And I look at people and I'm thinking, like, can they tell that I'm smiling? Do they know if I'm smiling or not? And I'm trying to see if I can communicate with them with the eyes. So I think with the design is that we are definitely communicating with our eyes. Even if we're upset about having to wear the mask, if we're frustrated, if we're fearful, if we're happy, if we desire to be social with one another, but since the social distancing, which actually is more like physical distancing, we still have that barrier there. So communicating with the eyes and the fabrics, et cetera, the sparkly fabrics playing off of the eyes with the light, I do consider that.
I mean, you mentioned feeling uncomfortable in the masks, and some of that is the heat in North Carolina. It's super humid and really warm to be wearing your masks outside. Are there any lessons from the modest fashion industry about making garments that work in a variety of temperatures and that work well in the heat?
Yes, there actually are. And I learned those lessons the hard way. I would do these fashion shows and travel and just surprise them and show them what I had. And they weren't going for it. They said, it's too hot. That fabric is too heavy. We can't do that here in Philly, you know. Or we can't do that in Texas. It's hot like that all the time. Or in Mexico or in Canada. We're saying, no, that fabric is just too thin. We need something that we can wear year-round. So I definitely learned some lessons there.
What are those lessons?
Go ahead. The lessons were that I have to have my clothing in layers, so that it can be versatile. For instance, I can have a jacket, a long swing coat, a swing jacket as I call them, and underneath is a dress that may be sleeveless. It's still higher up on the neck, but it's sleeveless so that they can take it off. They can take the jacket off. They can still have a dress on, and their arms may be showing, but actually they will probably go indoors. They will probably wear that indoors. So that's the versatility that I offer with the modest fashion.
How does that kind of lesson translate into mask design? I only have about 30 seconds left, but I'm curious.
Okay, it translates into mask design, whereas I know that they have to be light at the same time. And I did make one mask that was heavy, but I made a pivot, and I went back to making the lining of the fabric has to be lighter, but it still has to provide adequate coverage.
Shakuru Bilal is the founder, owner, and lead designer for Shakuru Couture. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You can find pictures of her work and learn more about her, her company, and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, Stacia Brown, and Josie Taurus. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Sean Rue also helped out today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.